You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The coronavirus pandemic has cut many of us off from our normal social lives. No more big family dinners, no more after-work happy hours with your friends. And older adults who are at higher risk for deadly complications from the virus have to be especially vigilant about physical distancing. That isolation comes with its own mental and physical costs. Joining us to talk about those challenges and how we can address them is Jeffrey Hoffman. He's an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Nursing, where he specializes in researching the care of older adults. Jeffrey Hoffman, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What have you been seeing about the ways that older adults are mentally affected by the shutdowns?
Yeah, I think there's tremendous concern out there of the effects on mental health from the social isolation due to the COVID situation. I think it's important to just sort of state right up front that the older adult population is extremely heterogeneous. We sort of provide this artificial threshold if you're over a certain age that you're an older adult, but there's tremendous variation in there. So to your point, to your question, there are people who live in assisted living facilities who may have, and other sort of congregate living facilities who may have other older adults around them. There are other people who sort of live on their own who are more socially isolated. There are variation just within people in the same settings who may feel more or less isolated. But I think it's fair to say in net that, this is a really big societal shift, and older adults already, many of them experience social isolation even in pre-COVID times. And this is sort of, put the gas pedal down and we're ramping up to 100 miles per hour. So there's tremendous concern. I think as well, we need to recognize that traditional avenues of support that were once there, things such as family caregivers coming in to visit, whether someone's in a nursing home or other assisted living facility or just at home, those sorts of visits are now restricted. So, we have amongst the sort of gerontologist community lots of concern about what's going on.
Yeah. And as you say, some of us, our personalities may just change. We may, some of us become a lot more hypersocial as we age and some of us become way more introverted. Is interaction important for both kinds of people?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think, there's tremendous beauty in the heterogeneity of human life and personality and how we all address things. And as you say, things change over time. It's hard to know, but the sort of resources, the availability of sort of community activities for people who want to reach out and access those things, those have been tremendously clamped down. We've all experienced that ourselves, even those of us who aren't in the sort of older age categories. The big issue when it comes to aging is autonomy and independence. And so regardless of your specific sort of characterological type, whether you're more extroverted or introverted, I think, everyone's feeling the push from this, but it's restricting all of our sort of avenues of independence. And so whether you choose to express your independence and autonomy through a more extroversion sort of centered means or not, all of us are being affected by this. So social loneliness and isolation, sort of loneliness being the subjectively felt experience of isolation, is going to hit us all in different ways. But I think it's on net, on average, affecting us all deeply is my take. Yeah.
What kind of physical consequences might this mean for seniors if they do have unmet needs?
Yeah, this is another area where, specifically with the research that I do a lot of work on injuries, specifically fall injuries. And I have actually tremendous concern that we could see some sort of disability epidemic that results from the COVID epidemic. And what I mean by that is that another sort of impactful consequence of isolation is we have what's called deconditioning. So we restrict our physical functioning, our physical activity, we become more sedentary. I think we've all, to some extent, experienced that, although I'll totally concede that, my wife and I have done way more walking than we ever did before and whatnot. But I think it's true to the extent that we get out less, we engage less socially and physically, that this deconditioning can happen. That can affect cognitive and physical functioning. And when you have those deficits in play, it can lead to, you know, to disability, to falls, to fall injuries. So when you couple that with what's going on with the healthcare system, where we're seeing many fewer visits, less capacity in the healthcare system to address sort of your typical standard sort of care modalities and patterns, things like post-acute care and rehabilitation, outpatient settings after, you know, after hospitalizations or elective care, elective surgeries. There's reason for great concern that we're going to see sort of an upswelling of fall injuries in the older adult population.
Even as the healthcare system is struggling to deal with the costs and pressures of the pandemic. The conversations that people have with their families and friends can sometimes be frustrating right now. You know, a lot of folks are, if you ask them how they're doing, they're just inclined to say, I'm fine. You know, I'm getting by. It's not fun, but I'm hanging in there. How do you approach getting people to acknowledge that they don't have to settle for just getting by or just getting through this? And, you know, that may involve getting some help.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to that. You know, it's sort of the key question. I'll take a few swings at it. I mean, so again, harkening back to sort of my area of study of falls and fall injuries, it's sort of one of the fascinating aspects of it is that there's a tremendous reluctance on the part of many older adults to discuss what I think we could concede are sort of stigmatic issues that like loneliness, mental health, falls, risk, fears of falling. I think there are really good explanations and reasons for those fears and that sort of reluctance. But overcoming that and sort of how to figure out how to reach across is a little more tricky. I would hazard to say that probably one way that could gain some traction is just going back to this notion of autonomy and independence. We find that when we talk to older adults about physical activity and fall risk, for instance, again, recognizing that sort of the discussion of falls may not apply to everything we're talking about here, but when it comes to falls, if you talk about independence and autonomy and how to have sort of well-being and a good life as we age, that works a lot better than saying, sort of discussing things in a negative sense. Do you not have a fall risk? Do you not have a gait and stability problem? Do you not have muscle wastage or, you know, other sorts of issues? There's just greater responsiveness when you sort of put autonomy, recognition of the need for autonomy first as opposed to you are a risk. I think societally the broader issue is there's ageism involved and we internalize that as we age as well. And so as a society we tend to think of aging as a process where we become more and more disabled. We have less to contribute. Our roles and responsibilities are restricted. You know, and that's something that we apply to older adults when we're younger and we possibly internalize as we age ourselves. And because of that, there's probably a reluctance to be stamped with that or sort of branded with that sort of weakness or fallibility when we become older. And so we just say we don't want to talk about it. That's sort of my what I surmise might be going on, but it's the million-dollar question, frankly, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Hoffman. He's at the University of Michigan School of Nursing, and he's a PhD researcher who specializes in the care of older adults. I was reminded by Michigan radio reporter Will Callen's feature that most of Michigan seniors do, in fact, live at home. Do you think that fact is well understood when we talk about policies around elder care?
I think that's a really good point. There's a lot of sort of misunderstood reality about sort of aging and housing and the healthcare system and how it applies to older adults. I think there's probably an expectation that most of us will end up living in some sort of nursing home or assisted living facility when we age, and that's just not the case at all. You know, the specific numbers, I'm not sure if it's 10 or 15%, but it's not a tremendous amount. We will all at some point, about 40 to 50% of us, be in a nursing facility at some point, and that could simply mean after a hip surgery, we'll be in a nursing facility for a couple weeks for rehab or something like that. You know, my grandma had a spiral fracture when she was on a cruise when she was 95 years old, and I don't know if she was dancing or something, but she had a pretty bad spiral fracture, and she was the most optimistic person I've ever known, and she, you know, she just went into her assisted living facility's sort of step down or step up, I guess, skilled nursing facility for about a month and a half. And then she was better and moved back to her apartment and things were better. But largely speaking, we have a population of older adults that's growing tremendously, and they're mostly going to be living out in the community. And our healthcare system's tried to adapt to that to some extent. The Medicaid program has a bunch of waiver and demonstration programs that try to allow states to redirect spending out to community programs as opposed to just sort of medicalized, very expensive nursing home care, which can cost $200 a day. But I don't know that people are fully aware of that. And I think if they were, they might sort of in a political sense be more willing to allow more spending on those sorts of things.
And at the same time, we do have this whole population of folks who are quite literally trapped, you know, with away from the reach of their families, sometimes unable even to communicate with their families if they're in the grip of the virus. What are your concerns right now for folks who are living in, I think you said, congregate care?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's these sort of technical terms of different sort of housing situations. But for people who are living in various forms of whether they're nursing homes or congregate care, you know, assisted living facility is a little bit different. But I think something that's worth keeping in mind is that we know, first of all, that that's where sort of the wildfire of COVID has been most impactful and scary. You know, there's been disproportionate caseload and massively disproportionate case fatality amongst nursing home residents. So I think 80% of all deaths so far, something like that, have been older adults in nursing facilities. And, you know, we've had all these problems with the protective equipment and whatnot, but we've also heard these sort of horrifically wrenching stories about family members unable to go visit. Medicare didn't allow sort of in-person visits. And, you know, I think what people may not recognize is that even someone living in a nursing facility, they still rely on family caregivers. And so family caregivers are sort of the unspoken component of how we're addressing older adult needs in this epidemic.
Family caregivers or in-home care services who make regular visits. So do you think that we're going to come to see assisted livings or other kinds of facilities in a different way because of this sort of recognizing that there are limits to the way we've been doing this?
I sure hope so. I think we feel that sort of in my research community, the policy community, that there's been some advancements over time, or what seem to be advancements in terms of Medicare creating star quality ratings for nursing home performance to sort of keep a handle on the type of care that older adults in those facilities are receiving. But we've seen during the epidemic, much as with all other sorts, all other parts of the healthcare sector, that there are big gaps in there. I think in Washington State, where there was sort of a super spreader, you know, one of the epicenters of nursing home, lots of fatalities in the nursing home, that it had a high star rating in the Medicare system, you know. So needing to rethink oversight of these places, how we get staff to be safe and go in and be safe themselves as they're providing care. I think we're going to have to spend a lot of time rethinking and rejiggering these things. And I hope policymakers will do those things, as well as recognize again the need for, you know, reaching out to family caregivers and allowing them to be part of this process. I think there's tremendous undervaluing or devaluing of the family caregiver role, whether it's helping patients with dementia who've been hospitalized with COVID or other older individuals with other sorts of limitations, not having a family caregiver there to help with shared decision making or palliative care or end of life, seeing them as family members are at the end of life. These have been really wrenching things, and we need policy solutions for them.
We're at this point in the pandemic now where we're far from the end of the road. How do you think, what might be a healthy way to think about the physical isolation that may still be necessary going forward?
I think even I ask myself that question sometimes. Mm-hmm. Here's something that I've been thinking about. You know, I would think that this epidemic presents us all with opportunities for for sort of growth and improvement, whether it's the healthcare system sort of pointing out the pre-existing sort of gaps or piecemeal application of policies as opposed to sort of really carefully thought through holistic policies. One of the big takeaways from all this is social capital, that how do we function as communities? How do we make sure that we prioritize our older individuals in our communities, whether locally or nationally? I think we're starting to recognize that there are tremendous disparities in terms of the different amounts of support that different older adults and communities are getting or providing. And maybe what we could do is think, you know, all of us, whether old or young, are experiencing loss of autonomy and independence right now, right? Like restrictions on our ability to feel that we're in control of things. And, you know, everything takes much longer to do, whether it's shopping and cleaning your groceries afterwards or whatnot. And to some extent, that might be a way to sort of empathize, find a way through to see what the aging process is like to some extent, where some of that encroachment of loss of autonomy comes to bear and things take longer to do. And I think if we can do that, we can sort of humanize the situation. What I would love to see come out of this is a greater, deeper, richer understanding of an appreciation of the older adult community and sort of a nationally mobilized effort, whether it's intergenerational supports, taking all these young individuals who may not be on college campuses and have extra time, or people who, musicians, artists, people who have lost work in the sort of economic issues we've had, to make phone calls, play music for older adults, like really like walk the walk and not just talk the talk. Like, how can we rebuild social capital? So my most optimistic take on all this is a healthy way to think about this is, gosh, you know, we've all Zoomed more than we ever have with family before. You know, there are really positive things. I've spent more time with my family in enriching, wonderful ways than ever before. Let's do that intergenerationally. Let's reach out to older adults. Let's support them technologically, et cetera.
Jeffrey Hoffman is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Nursing. Thank you so much for your thoughts on this. And we know you have a new arrival in the family, so congratulations on that as well.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and a privilege speaking with you, April. Thanks so much.